This is St. Pete X, affectionately known as SPX. SPX brings you St. Pete's brightest business people, civic leaders, and citizens who share their insight and expertise as well as their love of our great city. SPX is presented by the St. Petersburg Group. Head to stpete.co to check out more episodes, and by St. Pete's most effective marketing agency, Big C. Browse to bigc.co to see their work. Now enjoy the conversation. In addition to Ashley, joining us on SPX is Rick Holmans, the president and CEO of the Tampa Bay Partnership.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
It feels like our second episode because we've been picking Rick's brain for the last, I would probably say, 30 minutes.
And vice versa.
Yes. It's been a mutual, exchange of picking. And it's, you know, one of the things we called out immediately, you know, SPX, St. Pete X, and a lot of the St. Petersburg Group entities have a St. Pete flair. And now we're talking to the man that is really leading the charge in sort of the regional expansion of data and insight and really the advancement of this area.
I mean, I do feel like I'm cheating on St. Pete right now. So guilt. If the guilt comes through in my voice, it's real.
Well, that's the problem we've got.
That's true. Like,
we're all one big place. You know, we're all in this together. We're not competing with
that
each
guilt
other.
Into pride.
That's right.
We've long wanted to have you as a guest. Joe and I both participated in some data collection for in service of some of the work that you're doing and some of the outcome reporting of that. And I think we both said to each other more than once, you know, this is the work that we're doing on a granular level. And now we're witnessing some pioneers address it from a regional perspective. So congratulations to you.
Well, thanks. Thanks. No, the partnership, as you say, is working on a regional scale. And we think that's just so critical because we are a large metropolitan area. We're the 18th largest in the country, but we often operate like a bunch of medium-sized cities or medium-sized counties. And in many cases, we find ourselves competing with each other, arguing with each other. And, you know, I've been to Washington and Tallahassee, and I've seen numerous communities from Tampa Bay follow each other into rooms to pitch, you know, the officials for something where we just have a so much better chance of being successful if we all went in together for one meeting and said, here are the three things that we want. And we'd probably walk out with them if we did that.
And it's interesting, and I'll let you tell the tale, but, you know, coming from early in your life, growing up in Boston, school in Wisconsin, but found yourself in New Mexico as your career sort of took bloom, and coming to Tampa Bay with some political experience and also some experience in media. And if you think about the merging of those two practices, you're in the right spot. But talk about the work that you did in New Mexico.
Well, I've grown up in a family, and I think my personality is I love to do things that make a difference in wherever I am. And there's kind of a legacy of public service. So my life has always crossed between journalism, starting as a reporter, editor, owning my own publishing company, to political, working on campaigns in Massachusetts, in Philadelphia, and then ultimately in New Mexico, running for mayor myself of Albuquerque in 2001. Losing the race, but then working for Bill Richardson, who was running for governor and doing all of his policy work from A to Z, and then becoming his Secretary of Economic Development. And so spent about 10 years together with Governor Richardson, and that was a real eye-opener to work at that level in a policy situation. And it was a great blending of the skills I had learned as a reporter to become a instant expert on, you know, a multitude of subjects, and then be able to synthesize the information, present it, and then act on it. So I've always enjoyed doing that. And this job right here is a terrific blend of all of that together.
Can I say something that probably has never been said to you? I'm really glad you lost.
Yeah.
I'm really glad you lost.
Well, I am a firm believer that you learn a whole lot more through losing than you do through winning. So
yes, because now we get the great fortune of having you in our area, and you talk about, you know, the ability to, you know, extract information and stories through journalism, but ultimately it's about interpretation. And Joe and through many of the St. Petersburg Group's initiatives, we're always talking about St. Pete 2.0. And I think that we don't struggle with the lack of information. I think where the next step is interpretation, assimilation, and action. And so I think that we're sort of speaking the same language in terms of it's one thing to sort of know what the issue is, but what do you do and how do you interpret that and your role in that?
Yeah, it's just about tangible things, right? We've talked about potential a long time. We've talked about the Renaissance a long time.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of becoming a next tier city is you have to have that collaboration that you're talking about. I just don't think we can do it on our own.
Well, and I think, you know, you guys are involved with the St. Petersburg group, and the partnership is very much a similar kind of, you know, convergence of CEO type individuals on the regional scale. And one of the really interesting things about working with CEOs is they demand results. They're impatient. There's an urgency. And you can't tap dance. You can't, you know, talk sort of rhetorically or conceptually for too long. You've got to have an action plan, and you have to deliver results. And I'm very much that way too. So I thrive in that environment. So that's really the culture of the partnership, is to be action oriented and results oriented.
So with all the acumen at the table on both sides of the bay, why is it, you know, business people clearly understand the power of working together. That's why mergers and acquisitions happen, you know, economies of scale, all of that. What do you see as the major impediment to not transferring that knowledge from what works in business and how I do a lot of things to, we can't do that as a region together?
Well, it's interesting in the business community as well. You know, I think one of our greatest weaknesses in Tampa Bay, as I mentioned before, is our division, how we are fractured and how we're so parochial in our thinking and in our actions. And we really don't have very many regional structures at all that cover the metropolitan area. The partnership is one of probably three or four. You know, there's Tampa Bay Tech, the technology group. There's the Tampa Bay Water that was created about 20 years ago now to deal with regional water issues. But beyond that, there's not a whole lot. And actually, you get into the business community, and our primary business organizations are defined by their geographic boundaries, too. There's the St. Pete Chamber. There's Pinellas County. There's Hillsborough County, the Tampa Chamber. And while they try to work together on some levels, there's not a great sort of assimilation, or each community has its own business leadership. And so part of what we're trying to do is to create another level that can pick up on the most thorny kind of challenges facing Tampa Bay, and a small group of highly influential people try to tackle those.
So clear. Ashley's waiting to say something, but shut it down. But I think there's an important perspective there, right? Because we put out a lot of language about collaboration, but perhaps it has to be bottom up. But at the same time, I think you can have companion organizations that sort of work to do that without having to break down the structure of the local organizations. They would be companion organizations with a different mission.
I also think that in addition to when you talk about business acumen, I think the two other issues at play is that even though the different entities have their own identified issues and there may be some similarities, I think that you've talked about how media can play a role in overall buy-in. If we all agree that not smoking is a significant issue that we all play a role in, then how it's integrated into school curriculums, how it's integrated into PSAs, into sort of overlaying nonprofit missions across the region. I think that it's that proliferation and that to get that optimal buy-in, I think we've lacked. And irrespective of all sort of checking the box and agreeing on some major areas where we should be advocating for change. And I think another one is, we've long struggled to articulate with many of our guests when we talk about an issue that we want to solve for, and the brilliance and the regional approach and that collaboration is the business acumen to walk entities through what that looks like and what that means for their bottom line. And I'll use that nonprofit community as an example. If we know that there's a redundancy of services and sort of mapping that crosses over that could best benefit from maybe a merger, maybe, you know, collaboration, consolidation, you name it. Maybe there's territorialism involved, but there's also a lack of business prowess to understand how to do it. And that may actually parlay into some talent concerns ultimately for the region. But I think that there's a paralytic effect to the lack of true business acumen that we may be struggling with.
You know, going back to, you know, our conversation before we came on the podcast about, as you set up these new sort of structures, you don't want to diminish what anybody is doing. Our efforts in transportation and regional transit's a great example of the strategy there is to create a new organization that is doing something that's not happening today, which is regional transit. So HART in Hillsborough County is not doing that. PSTA in Pinellas County is not doing that. there needs to be an organization. So part of its function is to bring the other players around the table and create an environment of collaboration so that as the regional system is put into place, the county-based systems are aligning their routes, their equipment, their investments that they're making into a larger structure. So it's not taking away from anybody, but it's adding another organization that will help to make the county-based ones even stronger. But at the same time, by connecting them to each other and creating a regional system. So it's not trying to impose something, it's trying to reinforce and to build and make it stronger, but to have the players sitting around a regional table together.
So I think a lot of that is subject dependent as well, because when you use Ashley's example of smoking prevention, I think that that doesn't directly, I mean, obviously impacts many things, but it doesn't directly impact a chamber. And so I think to get people aligned on that is a tough slog. And I think it's a slog that people have failed at because you're trying to bolt on meaning. It's common sense meaning, but it doesn't align with the infrastructure that they'd built within their organizations. Transportation more closely aligns and impacts more directly everybody. And so it can be more readily absorbed. And so I think a lot of that is subject matter. And I think, again, going back to that key perspective of overlaying organizations versus the ground up approach, I think, you know, you're really setting yourself up for that tough journey if you try to impose these things that are logical and true, but not baked into, you know, the sort of ecosystems that people have created over time.
Yeah. And there's a lot of power that comes from the ground up, from the grassroots and from those organizations that are already in place. And, you know, I find ourselves being extremely sensitive to that as we begin a regional conversation, to be very aware, sensitive to, and acknowledging of and supportive of all the work that's already been done on a county scale.
Well, similar to the Foundation for Healthy St. Pete, we had Randy Russell in here, and they have a model that a lot of community assessment, essentially, where you bring people in to essentially capitalize on sort of the groundswell of information. And they even compensate individuals and entities that come and lend their expertise and their insights to better inform ultimate decisions. And you took a similar approach, or your organization did, spent a lot of time hosting roundtables, and the conversations morphed from key areas of, you know, what are your pain points? What are the goals for your mission and organization? How do you measure outcomes? Because in my specific session, there was a conversation about talent, education, graduation rates, and we were all measuring success very differently. So if you look at, you know, what it takes to graduate high school, or what it takes to actually even graduate VPK and move into school-age programming, it varies. And so we may not be boasting ourselves to the degree that we could, presumably, if we have a different way of assessing performance based, you know, in comparison to the other 19 regions.
You're talking about the regional competitiveness report that we introduced last year, and we're in the process of putting that together again for this year and actually taking it more online so it will be much more accessible to people, customizable, and kind of consumable. So that's very exciting to do. But the goal there is to create something, a platform, so that we can, of data and indicators, each of which has a very, you know, human side to it, you know, so we want to get into that as well. But where we can come to some agreement as to what's important to us and what do we measure as we go forward. And if we're developing strategies around how we plan our community, how we are, the health of our community, the vibrancy of our community, what are the indicators that we want to measure and what are the outputs that we're going to look to affect?
Give us a teaser. What are some of the areas or issues that are covered in this competitiveness report?
I think sort of the headlines that came out of last year, you know, was a couple of things. One, which is what we know, that there's a lot of growth happening here, and we're top ranked in the top, you know, 3 to 5 of the cities that we look at nationally in terms of growth of jobs and population, things like that. But as you look at the more closely and you look at our average wages, our median household income, our gross regional product per capita, we are at the bottom of the list. We're 19 or 20 out of the 20 communities that we study. The real wake-up call for us was as we looked at the talent indicators and we looked at the level of educational attainment in our population. An example would be, you know, for, you know, the 25 years and older, the percentage of the population that has a bachelor's degree or higher, I think we're around 27, 28%. Well, the communities that have the highest gross regional product per capita, the highest average wages, are coming in the neighborhood of 40 to 50%. so much more of an educated population that's there. Either they're doing a better job of retaining the ones that they educate and attracting new young people who have educated. And that's key to economic growth, is to have that level of education in the market.
And you may have opened a can of worms, because evident in our roundtable that shared these outcomes, if you look at education attainment being an issue, you could probably assume that there are multiple variables or factors contributing to the low attainment rate, right? It's whether it's transportation to schools or the structure of the family unit and what's happening there to food insecurity, right? So now you may have, you know, gotten yourself into a hole.
And that's a good can of worms to open up, because we have to see the connections between these issues. And some of the really fascinating work that's taking place, one of the partnerships we developed through this work was with USF, with Moez, Dean Lamayam at the College of Business. And they have a Center for Creative Analytics and Data there. So we're partnering with them, and what they're bringing to the table, in addition to sort of real-time data, is they're able to enter in for all these 20 communities that we compare ourselves to, all of the data going back 10, 20 years for all the communities. And then what they're looking for are correlations between these indicators. So what are the ones that have the highest leverage? If you move the graduation rates coming out of high school, does that affect three other indicators in there? If you move the average wages, does that affect the, you know, affordability index? Or transit, you mentioned transit. We're 20 out of 20 with our transit supply. If you start to move that, what kind of impact does that have on other indicators in terms of access to jobs and affordability, things like that?
That's brilliant. Congratulations on that partnership, because to my earlier point, it's largely been identified that that's something that's missing, that forecasting and being able to identify those different levers. You can all agree that there's an issue, but understanding the indicators and what's accessible, what's doable, what's tangible, to Joe's point, what's actionable. And then to your earlier point, being able to share that and to provide narrative to support it.
And I think it's also huge that it's on the platform like it is, because it gives people that incentive. They can find their own incentive to go and use the data to serve themselves. But in the process of doing that, they're absorbing these different perspectives and these different aspects. And it lets them, without being told, but discover for themselves through this, you know, again, self-incentivized process, because they're getting value for their own needs. They're also learning about the connections.
Yep.
And that's the way you can start to get people to absorb that into their operations and their foundations.
Yep. When I was brought in to lead the partnership, I was basically given the keys to the car and said, we want to shift from an economic development marketing organization to public policy and advocacy. You figure it out. And so, you know, I immediately kind of figuratively hit the road and started looking at other models in places like Minneapolis and Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Columbus and Charlotte, and saw that one thing common to all these places is they did a really good job of benchmarking their community's performance against others. And they were data-driven and fact-based and research-based in what they did. So I brought this concept, you know, which, so not an original concept, but deriving from success in other markets, to the table. The first conversation around the table was, well, that sounds like a good thing to do, but we're not going to release that publicly, are we? Because that was the mindset, you know, was very sort of, ooh, you know, there might be some bad news in there. And we're accustomed to just trumpeting out the good news. And so we got to be careful. And my answer back was, you know, that's key to this being successful, is owning it, releasing it. And I said, a company looking at this market, they have access to all this data, if they've got any smarts at all. And so they know it coming to the table. They're going to be far more impressed if we know it and we're doing something about it than if we kind of shine it on and pretend that we don't have an issue with it.
And that's been a big pivot, because I will tell you, most of the assessment types of gatherings I go to now actually push how bad we're doing as much as how good we're doing. You know, there's always that. That has really changed that mindset to, hey, let's take this as a challenge and let's do better. So that was an important shift.
Well, I mean, we all know that on a personal level, you know, self-awareness, you got to recognize what areas where you need improvement and then work on them in a methodical, kind of calculated way.
I admit to no wrongdoing. Well, one of the things I wanted to mention, you know, when we were listening to some of these outcomes, there was somebody in the room that talked about not only being able to identify the different levers that would influence, you know, change, but being able to quantify financially, you know, if we invest, let's say, you know, X number of dollars in something, quantifying what we stand to lose or quantifying what we drive into our community. And I think that that's another layer that might be missing. I think that really get us where it hurts and understanding what not doing something does to our property values, to our children's opportunities, and quantify that in dollars could be pretty powerful at one point.
Absolutely. You know, last year when we introduced this report with Dean Lamayum at USF, they were able to unveil kind of their initial modeling and correlation work that they did. So they were able to then put up a chart with looking where we are today and looking 5 years in the future. And they say, based on what we saw here from, you know, graduation rates, for example, if we move this by this 1% or 2%, watch what happens to the circles on this chart in terms of other indicators in Tampa Bay. And they put it, they started the cycle and the arrow went straight up and everybody started cheering in the room because they saw a path forward based on the data that was in front of them.
Personally, in our nonprofit, we've looked at Harvard studies that measure outcomes for education specifically. And Harvard did a study, every dollar that's invested in early learning, I'm just giving an example, yields about 6 to 9 in return to the community through jobs, through crime reduction, through, you know, healthcare costs, because you can make correlations between an educated individual and maybe some different decisions they make with regards to nutrition or drugs or what have you. And so I think that that might be a layer of the rhetoric that's maybe largely missing when we talk about the contextualizing of some of the pure static numbers that we have.
And these kind of conversations, as you said, Joe, before, are, this is part of the pivot. These are great conversations to have where we're making these connections between these things, but we've got to have a platform of good data to work from. Otherwise, we're just throwing around conjecture and opinions and anecdotes, and it's got to be based in some hard data. And that's what we're trying to do here, is create that platform for the community to use. But then we're, you know, taking this and, you know, I said the alarm bells that went off with talent. So we're actually now embarking on a multi-year effort, and we're focused on what's called an employer-led, demand-driven workforce strategy, where rather than kind of pushing the supply of labor and degrees forward, looking at it from the other side, where you're understanding what the demand is in the market for specific degrees and education and certificates. And then you're pulling that out of viewing it almost as a supply chain issue. So being able to have much more clarity from the business side to the community colleges, to the public school system, to the four-year universities of exactly what's needed for our businesses here to prosper, to be able to hire the right kind of people to grow. And the supply chain, as we, you know, refer to it, appreciates that very much because they get a whole lot more clear direction that they haven't had to date. So there's a model out there that we're following from the U.S. Chamber called Talent Pipeline Management. Again, we're not original. It's been done in dozens of other communities before, but never here. And we're in the process now of identifying the first employer collaborative that would, you know, represent either a specific industry or a cross-industry function, you know, like finance or HR or technology. And to focus on that first one and get it up and running really well with the aligned supply chain and then be able to replicate it for the next one, the next one, the next one. But that's changing the culture. It will provide very specific results. We'll be able to track, we'll have a dashboard, we'll be able to track the talent pipeline and how it's performing for this specific industry. And then we'll be able to replicate that. But that's an example of using the data that we learned from this report, convening leadership and moving forward with a specific action plan that will deliver results. And I think we want to walk the walk from the partnership level. And that's the same thing other groups can do in their own different areas.
I was curious, just backing up, I've heard about the move away from economic development originally before you joined, but I never got the sort of logic behind that. It was such a big change for the partnership to move away from to economic development to advocacy. Do you know why that happened?
I think at one level, the, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when the partnership was originally stood up, the leaders envisioned a true regional economic development organization that would market Tampa Bay as one, and primarily Hillsborough and Pinellas County. Fast forward, and Hillsborough has its own very professional EDC with, you know, the president of it now is the existing chairman of the International Economic Development Association. So, you know, very qualified guy, Craig Richard, in Manatee, there's a Sharon Hillstrom with the Bradenton area. In Polk County, there's Sean Malott. Bill Cronin's up in Pasco. There's really seasoned pros in each one of the seats. Mike Mydell here in Pinellas running, and JP is running the St. Pete EDC. So you've got a very, you know, seasoned group of professionals running these organizations, and they are accustomed to kind of doing it their own way, and they've created good collegial partnerships between themselves. So there's not really the need anymore at that level for one organization to do everything. And I think at some point, I think it would be beneficial for these EDCs to develop some sort of slightly more formal structure to represent and market Tampa Bay as a metropolitan area versus being, you know, perceived as competitors with each other. But they need to do that themselves. It's not up to the partnership to step in and say, hey, come around the table, we're going to. So what was really missing was on these issues like transportation, on workforce development, on, you know, the role that the partnership played 20 years ago with the water issue, is the ability to kind of assert ourselves as a region and tackle some of these tough issues that can only be dealt with on a regional scale. And there was no organization that was doing that. They were doing it in the counties and in the cities, but nothing overarching. So, you know, and again, modeling after what they saw happening in other markets, particularly Minneapolis. There was a group called the Itasca Project up there, which was a group of about the 10 CEOs of the companies that were headquartered there. And they were able to, you know, leverage their collective influence to move the needle on some big, big issues. And I think the leadership sitting around the table said, you know, we could do the same thing here if we organize ourselves differently. I would just say at the time, one of the big things was the partnership had a mixture of public and private money in it. So it actually had elected officials sitting at the table. And the biggest change that we made in June of 16, when we dissolved the old organization and stood up a new one, was we only accepted private money into the partnership. We don't allow a public dollar to come in.
That was a question I was about to ask you. The private sector, how much do you think we overinflate our role in systemic change? Because if you talk about policy influence, and when, you know, in the roundtable, someone said, you know, what's not on the list is who's in office, you know? And who we've elected, and just how much we're not seeing in terms of, you know, the public sector and how much of a role that plays ultimately in this change.
Yeah, I mean, the elected officials play a huge role, and we actually have not been in Tampa Bay very active at all as a business community, for one, in affecting, you know, those races and identifying, you know, who would be a good leader to have in these key positions and then coalescing around that individual to move them in or to move somebody out who is holding us back, you know, from the kind of progress that we need. So other communities have a lot better developed kind of experience with that. Tampa Bay is very immature, I think, in that way. And I think that's one of the things that we have to move forward with very, you know, cautiously, slowly, because there's a lot of landmines as one gets into the political environment, because there's corporate agendas and there's community agendas, and sometimes they intersect and sometimes they conflict, and one has to kind of navigate through all that. So it's a tough thing to do, but I think we are having those conversations within the partnership, and they're intriguing, interesting conversations to have.
And taking back to your political life in New Mexico when you were a campaign manager for Richardson, and then you moved into the EDC, leadership of the EDC there, you had a pretty big gig that led to an interesting meeting with a very influential person that we all may know. I'd love for you to share that story.
You know, I was the Secretary of Economic Development for Richardson. Part of our strategy was to get in on the ground floor of brand new industries. And one of the obvious ones for New Mexico was commercial spaceflight and the emergence of what we are now seeing as the reusable launch vehicle industry, the idea of a booster rocket going up and instead of falling into the sea and being discarded, actually flying back and landing on a, you know, and being used again. And there was a suddenly an explosion of new technologies related to reusable launch vehicles. And so when we took office, a group of old NASA pioneers, because we had the backup landing strip for the space shuttle in New Mexico and a NASA facility, they came to me and they said, you know, if this industry starts to go, there are plans already developed for an inland spaceport. And it's perfect because it's restricted airspace. It's at a high level, so you're not burning as much fuel to get into space. And it's in a remote location, so it's an ideal spot.
And it's already well trafficked with alien visitors anyway, right?
Well, that was one of the jokes. We're doing this to give those guys a route back home, you know? So anyways, there was the XPRIZE Cup and Richard Branson and Burt Rutan and the White Knight and spaceship. And so it launched our interest in building a spaceport. And I, you know, flew over to London and hung out in the waiting room of Virgin Companies there and got in to see Will Whitehorn, the president of the Virgin Companies and Virgin Galactic, and recruited him and Richard Branson, his boss, to come to New Mexico and locate their very simple handshake deal between us all that if we build a spaceport, they'll locate their world headquarters and primary operating base at that spaceport. And that evolved over the next 24 months into about an 800-page legal document trying to define a facility that didn't exist and a business model that didn't exist with legal obligations going both ways, launched the spaceport. And it's now fully operational and waiting for, you know, Branson and his team to go through their final stages of testing. And we hope to begin commercial launches in 2019 from the spaceport.
And this might be a segue to get into how you think, but you had some interesting insights that you picked up from Richard Branson that maybe have influenced you as well, just about his characteristics and his uncanny leadership qualities.
Just one thing, working with their organization, it's one of the most creative and driven organizations, and getting to know the people involved there, just this combustible kind of combination of creative energy and innovation, along with just a hardcore driven, you know, work ethic and very disciplined project managers, you know. Everything's got to go just right. But then in the middle of all that, just explosions of ideas and creativity. And that to me, you know, came directly from Richard.
Who you ironically describe as really laid back, right?
Well, I got to spend some time with him on Necker, his little island with his home that's burnt down a couple times.
Poor Rick.
Well, I had to fly him back from his big announcement in New Mexico on the state plane. And the only way we could do that is if a state employee went on the plane. So I had to go back with him and spend a night there with him. But he, you know, got to observe him at work, which was in his flip-flops and his bathing suit and his T-shirt, sitting back in the a little chaise in his, quote, office with open windows all around, with his assistant sitting at a little, you know, rickety table there, and her reading to him the emails that came in and him saying, well, tell him this, tell him that, tell him this. And just a very loose, kind of laid-back style that he has. You know, he's dyslexic, so his absorption of information has to be very high level. It's got to, you know, capture his imagination, his interest right away. It's got to be concise, but it's got to show where it's going. And I learned a lot just through glimpses of that in the most effective kind of communication that one can have with a person that has a limited bandwidth, for whether they're a high-level CEO and they've got 100 things going on at once, or whether they have dyslexia. You know, it's the same kind of principles of communication.
Any tips?
Keep it succinct and go one by one and always ask specifically for an answer is the way I position things when I'm dealing with my executives and like for people to deal with me.
Avoid the abstract and the sort of the long narrative, cut to the chase, and then specifically ask for feedback.
Yep. Yep. Joe, have we kept your interest?
You have. I was like, I knew we were going to have to segue, and we weren't getting out of here until Ashley talked about Richard Branson. So she jumped in and got that.
Now it was actually a nice segue.
Was it? I think it was pretty forced.
Well, actually, we did. One of our great experiences was when he came out to see the location for Spaceport America. And I flew from Santa Fe in a helicopter with him, one of his top guys, Alex Tai, and Will Whitehorn. So the four of us were in a helicopter together with our little headsets on, our speakers. And we hadn't named the facility yet. And I realized I'm sitting here with probably the best branding expert in the world. And what an opportunity to go through an exercise to name the
spaceport. She's just going to tell you Virgin Space Center. That's the problem.
No, so we went, I introduced the idea. We started throwing out names, and I'll give credit to Richard. Spaceport America came out, and it was simple, straightforward, and it just made sense. And we all looked at each other and we said, that's it.
Those are the best ideas when it happens like that. So my segue is you've had the unique position of being a long time in the journalism space, building newspapers, and then transitioning into the political space. And so you've seen both sides of it. So with all the rhetoric flying back and forth, what is your sort of take on news and politics and the interplay between the two? I guess more specifically, I'd love to hear what your experience was on the political side, having to deal with journalists, having been one previously.
It's not a question you gave me in advance to think about. I will tell you that I love news. I love newspapers. I walk out every morning at, 5:45 to pick up my Tampa Bay Times from the driveway. I'm very traditional in that way and love to spend, a good half hour, reading through the paper. And I'm dismayed by what's happening in newsrooms and especially at the local level, how there is such severe cutbacks on journalists and reporters and editors and the coverage of local news, because I think that's absolutely essential for an enlightened citizenry, And I think the news media plays a critical function there that's key to our democracy. So that's a high-level thought, but I think we're seeing it play out in some somewhat destructive ways now by the disintegration of that industry at the local level. And seeing the ability for, organizations, individuals to generate their own news, and whether one calls it fake news or fabricated news or user-generated, there's all these different channels and people can kind of pick what they want to hear and go with that. So I think there's a really important discussion taking place about where we go with that. And I think that goes back to the importance of hard data and facts and figures and good research that has to be part of the equation going forward. From a political standpoint, I ran for mayor. I loved it. I have to confess, I came in 5th out of 7 in the race.
Crushed 2 people, though. They were,
I didn't crush them, but I squeaked out a 5th place finish. And there were some huge issues around my race in particular, which had to do with campaign financing and me having to challenge something. It's a whole other story, but going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And getting tagged with a particular story that was really a side story compared to the campaign. And also with 9/11 that happened just, a month before the election. Those were 2 of the contributing reasons why I didn't do a little bit better in the race. But no, I've always, taken a kind of a big picture towards the media, towards reporters, to coverage. And my approach has always to be very open, transparent, responsive, never hide from a reporter's call. If I can't answer something, just to say it, but I always err towards openness and transparency and responsiveness. And I will say that coming here to Tampa Bay, I found amongst many of the leaders a real defensiveness when it came to the media. And I found it very harmful to opening up a more constructive dialogue. And I've tried to do that differently.
Being open is great, but you are giving up the power of your narrative, though, if you're not careful, right? Just putting that raw data out there. And I think that's what people get burned by, is if you have people who need or feel like they need a certain level of gravitas, good or bad, or just intensity in what they write, that they'll tend to inflate things or whatever. And I think that loss of control is what...
Well, and part of that is before you release something, you think about it from the perspective of a reporter. When I'm putting something out in the public domain, I always read through it several times, pretending I'm a reporter, looking for what am I going to write about, and making sure that I'm extracting those points and I'm responding to them up front rather than waiting for somebody to ask me about them.
I feel like I can understand some of the hesitation with regards to media. And I think that, you spoke about the different channels and the leaning into fake news or a lack of trust of sources and legitimacy. And I think that somebody recently said that it used to be, and this probably before that took place, that, it was sort of innocence until proven guilty. Now we sort of live in a culture where it's presumably everyone is guilty until proven innocent. There's a different nature to how we are responsiveness and our what we give benefit of the doubt to. And I feel like it probably is a bit thornier of a climate now in general.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that very much so.
And I'm curious, you talk about how that may have your news prowess may have worked against you during your political campaign. Did that motivate you to sell your publication, or were there other motivations at play to sort of get you out of that business?
No, and I don't think it worked against me. I think actually it helped, but there were some big issues that came up, and I was able to kind of see, I had never been before the subject of so many headlines.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting experience to go through that I actually relished and found fascinating and learned from as I did it. But no, before I got into the race, I had divested of sold off the business newspaper and sold off other parts of my publishing company so that I could focus on running for mayor.
Got it.
And so that was a clear decision there.
Do you miss it?
No, I love what I'm doing. I really do. I do miss, you know, the reporting part. I would say I'd go back to my roots and...
Hey, I know a place that needs some good reporting.
You can turn the tables on us if you want. Ask us some questions.
You know, but I found the process of reporting, of asking questions and listening, I found that very helpful, not only when I was a publisher selling advertising, because that's what sales is all about, is asking good questions and listening and providing a solution. But also in the work I do now is if, you know, as we get into the regional transit issue and transportation, I've become in many respects, I think, a real expert to the degree that I can without a formal education in that workforce development. Those are the skills I learned as a reporter, to ask a lot of questions, to listen, to read, and to report out on what I'm learning.
You know, it's so interesting. Now that you say that, I'm thinking about us connecting prior to going on the air, and you conversing with Joe, and you asked a lot of questions. And I really interpreted that as evident of a specific type of leadership, really invested, really connected. And that's also, you know, evidence of your just innate curiosity. But I wonder if that enhances your leadership.
Well, I'm not going to, you know, reflect on whether I'm a good or bad leader, but I will tell you
that's his mayor candidate answer right there.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, you talk about the act of empathy.
I think it's critical to good leadership is to have empathy and to be able to ask and listen. And so in that note, I'll let you finish your sentence.
Oh, no. I think that it's, you know, I've observed similar meetings, and the dynamic sometimes is a little bit more mutual, or sort of maybe there's less contribution on behalf of the individual at play. I honestly, I think it's, to me, it immediately created an affinity for you. And so I wonder if that's worked really well for you as you've navigated different circles and different climates, just your innate curiosity, because people like to talk about themselves. And
they do. And they'll often share very personal things and deep things and share great lessons, you know, with you.
Yeah. And think about what other leaders may lose in not having that approach. Trust, information, you know, opportunity.
Sure.
I don't know. You don't like the fact that I went there?
No, I love it. Moving on.
Okay.
We had Michael Pastrich on, who was the CEO of the Florida Orchestra, just stepped down. And before that, Hank Hine was on. And one of the things that jumped out at me was there's sort of a, what I would call a critical mass you have to make what they do work. And, you know, for the Dolly, you have to have a secure, beautiful museum to be the Dolly Museum. And for the orchestra, you need to have 80 or 100 or whatever it is, people who have practiced and who are playing together. And anything below that, you know, the value can kind of fall off a cliff, right? People aren't going to go to look at one painting. You know, people aren't going to go and see, you just can't get the same thing out of it. But at the same time, you know, they aren't self-supporting mechanisms, right? None of those can exist without philanthropy. And I wonder if journalism might follow a similar track, because I think that one of the key factors of journalism, people always think about the reporter and then the story, but that's very granular and floaty. And, you know, what makes journalism a true check and balance to power, there's a critical mass you have to have in the infrastructure behind that. You know, the ability to go places, the ability to develop sources, the fact checking, the lawyers, the researchers, and all of that. And what we're finding now is a lot of the institutions that did that are suffering, right? We see all the papers that are closing and losing that critical mass. And even the New York Times is starting to shrink its office space. And, you know, they're suffering financially because Facebook and Google are taking all their advertising money. And then, you know, what's emerging from that is the supported model, which is Bezos coming in and you know, being the funding source for the Washington Post. And, you know, I wonder if at some point people aren't going to have to step up and support that critical mass in journalism the same way they do other nonprofits.
Well, and we see that right here in Tampa Bay with the Tampa Bay Times. You've got the Poynter Institute, which is the owner of the Tampa Bay Times. You know, we saw this past year, $12 million investors in the organization. I can guarantee you they did not invest for a huge financial return, but they, from what I've heard, invested primarily because they believe very strongly that a good quality, robust newspaper is important for a healthy community. So that's what they were investing in, the model that you're, you know, suggesting. So I think there have got to be some new models that develop there. But at the root of it, we've got to keep the granular, investigative, detailed quality of, you know, what journalism has always been. If we lose that, which is what requires, you know, the resources to do, then I think we've lost something very precious.
So we end every show with a shout out. This is some attention that we can give to some people who have done good work, or a person or a group of people who have done good work and don't get all the attention they deserve, or you just want to give them some more. And usually we have some rules. So I'm going to say it can't be anybody in Tampa. It has to be somebody in St. Pete.
No.
You didn't tell me that first.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. We love Tampa. And you've turned us all around. We're ready. We're ready to collaborate. So,
well, you know, the person that came to mind as you were saying that was Mark Blumenthal, who, you know, drove this, you know, event called Synapse, which is much more than an event. It's actually a whole development of regional infrastructure around entrepreneurship and innovation and connecting people. And I've just been so impressed with his energy and his ability to kind of create something massive out of, you know, thin air. Not thin air at all. He brought all the pieces together and created that critical mass and really practiced collaboration and collegiality. And the first event was a huge success. And I know they're building the web infrastructure to accompany it. And now they're looking at doing it again later this year. So yeah. Very proud of him and the work that he and his team did.
He's coming in, isn't he?
He is. And yeah, it's a nice segue because to show our collaboration and appreciation for Tampa, he's actually scheduled to be a guest on the show in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, and he's so far beyond Tampa. He's truly the super region. And he's a big thinker. And he's an example of the, you have to look at entrepreneurship and innovation on a regional scale because that's when you capture all the incredible assets that we have. And venture capitalists that we have and funding streams that we have. If you take something like that and you just work in the silo of one city, you're constrained by the limits of the geographic boundary and you're missing a lot of opportunities, you know, throughout the region that want to participate and want access. And I think that's what Mark is doing, is he's opening up those channels so that we can all work together.
How beautiful would it be if Mark named Rick? That's his shout out.
He won't.
We've never had like a perfect alignment. Like stars crossing.
I'm just going to say Rick's name 6 or 7 times throughout. Kind of like hypnosis seed the idea in his head.
It would help if you wrote it and just put it right
can
on the table.
Can you all give me a word that rhymes with Romans? I'm trying to think. What?
Now you're using my line.
That's true. Well, you were an amazing guest. Thank you so much for joining us
today. It's a pleasure to be here. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You made it to the end of another great episode. For show notes, head to stpete.co to the show notes page, which includes links to all the resources mentioned in the show, as well as quotes and key insights from the show and information about the guest and the host. Thanks again to our sponsor, Big C. Head to Big C, that's BIGSEA.co to check out their work. And if you like what you heard, make sure to share this episode on social media and leave a comment. See you next time.